I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Fixing American Politics with Ideas from the Realm of Business. We'll spend this hour with Catherine M. Gale, founder of the Institute for Political Innovation. She says the duopoly of the Republican and Democratic parties limits the kind of candidates and ideas voters get to choose from because primary elections favor the most extreme candidates in either party. We'll talk about widening the selection with something called Final Five voting and about why Gale does not recommend trying to run government like a business. Our conversation starts after a short break. Are quick to blame Republicans for what's broken in our government. Republicans are sure Democrats are the ones impeding forward momentum. But maybe the real problem is that these two parties share total control over American politics, and that duopoly crowds out independent competitors with better ideas. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest thinks the problem starts with how we do political primaries. Those early elections tend to reward the most extreme partisans, despite the fact that the customers for elected leaders, individual American voters, tend to hold more moderate views. So how can we increase the viability of new kinds of ideas and candidates trying to enter politics so that the parties have an incentive to actually do what Americans want them to do? Catherine M. Gale joins us to talk about this. She is founder of the Institute for Political Innovation and former president and CEO of Gale Foods. Her new book, written with Harvard Business School professor Michael E. Porter, is called The Politics Industry: How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Chris, I'm so pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's get something out of the way right off the top. This idea to apply market lessons to the political system is not the same thing as you making a case to run government agencies like a business, right?
You're exactly right. You know, and there is sometimes some confusion over that. So what we're saying is, no, government shouldn't be run like a business. It isn't a business. It actually exists to do things that business cannot do well. But what we're thinking about politics like a business is helpful is when we think about how right now the two parties are competing to serve who should be the customers. And right now, if we think about it, the customers, the citizens, the voters are not very happy. Actually, you know, we talk all the time about so much disagreement, but the one thing that 70 to 90% of people agree with across the spectrum is that Congress is broken. And so if we think of ourselves as customers, then, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans are not doing their jobs of creating themselves as a product, a service that's making us happy. And we have to ask, how could that be different? And it could.
So in markets, forces that shape competition include rivalry, the power of buyers and of suppliers, the threat of new players in the market, and the possibility of substitutes changing the way business gets done. How do those things translate to the politics industry?
Right. So the things that you've mentioned are tools of thinking about competition that we've used for decades in for-profit industries. And the analysis is rather long, and we go into it in detail in the book. For today, I think I'll bring up two particular points about this. So customers, one of the things that we analyze, and I mentioned this just a moment ago, there are various customers for the politics industry, and those include the regular citizens, the voters, the public interest, shall we say, and then there's also donors as a customer, special interests as a customer, and a separate segment that we break out, which is party primary voters as a customer. And when we look at this, it turns out that the only customers who have any power in this industry are the special interests and donors and party primary voters. The rest of the customers, so the rest of the voters, the vast majority of voters, really don't have any say in what people end up doing when they're elected. And so that's something that is really a badly designed political system, because those should be the most important customers. The second thing that we see when we look at this industry of politics is that the industry itself is doing really well. So if the listeners can just think about it, you always have a sense that the lobbyists, the campaign consultants, the media, the politicians themselves, that that's all going pretty well, that there's plenty of money and power to go around in there. And we have that sense, and it's backed up by the actual numbers, but we have that sense even as we know that we're totally dissatisfied. And I invite people to think about any other industry where they're the customer. Let's say that 70 to 90% of the people, you know, didn't like what was happening in a given industry, like they couldn't find products, and yet that industry made a lot of money. What would happen is a new competitor would see that industry as a huge opportunity, and they would come in and they would have to offer a new product to the dissatisfied customers and, you know, to give them what they need. But that never happens in politics. Right now, the two parties that we have are pretty much guaranteed to continue being the only two, no matter how dissatisfied the customers are. And the reason is that it turns out our parties work together in one very particular way, and that is to rig the rules of the game and to optimize them behind the scenes to protect themselves jointly from new competitors. And I often say, you know, that politics isn't broken, it's fixed, as in, you know, a fixed game. And that's not good for anybody. Well, actually, once again, it's pretty good for the political industrial complex. It's not good for any of us and our issues and our nationwide progress.
So what do the parties do together to weed out so-called spoiler candidates who may arise from an independent position with very different ideas?
Right. So getting back to this idea of, oh, if so many people, you know, sort of like the ideas of the Democrats or the Republicans, and yet they're dissatisfied with what they get done, or maybe they don't even like their ideas in the first place, why don't we see any new ideas and new candidates? That is because of what you just mentioned, the spoiler problem. Here's how that works. So right now, well, let me go back. The way we vote in the United States means that the winner is the one who has the most votes, but not necessarily a true majority. Now, having the most votes, that seems to make a lot of sense, but it has an odd impact. Think about if you had three candidates in a race. One of those candidates could win with only a plurality, meaning someone could win with 34% in a three-way race, with each of the other two candidates getting 33% each. So you would end up electing a candidate who, you know, where two-thirds of the public wanted someone else, didn't want that person. And this ends up creating a problem where every time a potential new competitor comes in, they're said to be a spoiler, or you as the voter are told that you're going to waste your vote, or, you know, you can't vote for Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate in 2016 presidential race, because he's on the right and he'll take votes away from Donald Trump and spoil the election for him. The same for Jill Stein, who was the Green Party candidate on the left. You weren't supposed to vote for her because you'd waste your vote and spoil the election for Hillary Clinton. That effect means that we don't have any new competition, because when they try to get started, they realize that they will be either simply inviting wasted votes, or they'll be spoiling the election for the candidate that they're to whom they're most similar. We have to get rid, and the parties love that that's the case. And they use it to hound out all the new competition. Most people don't even start running, which is why we don't see this as often as you would think. So that has got to be changed, and the fix is very simple, which is good news.
All right, we'll talk about that fix in just a second. I do want to go back to something that you mentioned, which is that special interests have power and primary voters have power. People might be thinking, well, anyone with a voter registration card can take part in a primary. How does participation in primary elections differ, in fact, from participation in general elections?
there's two things about the primary we need to understand, and that is its power in the actual process of deciding who wins. And the second thing is who votes in that election. So let's start with the second. People who vote in the primaries on both sides tend to be more ideological, oftentimes more single issue than voters as a whole. And so primary voters on the right will, in a sense, push the Republican candidates further to the right. And then primary voters on the left push their candidates further to the left. Now, this, you know, may have, let's say, it definitely affects who gets elected, but we need to take our eye off of who's getting elected for a moment and ask ourselves how primary voters and that process affects what whoever is elected does. Because in the end, you know, we mostly care about the results. We think we care about who gets elected, but in the end, if someone delivered results, you know, we'd like it pretty much. And what happens is, because both sides have been pushed so far away from each other, when they have a chance or almost a requirement in Washington, D.C. to come together to find a way forward, a consensus on our biggest issues, they can't, because they don't get to ask themselves, is this a good idea? Is this the right policy for the country? Is this what the majority of my constituents want? They don't get to ask any of those questions. They have to ask first, am I going to win or lose my next primary election if I vote yes on this, you know, big solution? And if the answer to that is no, and on all the complicated issues, the big stuff, it virtually always is for both sides, then both sides say, oh, that's no deal. And so essentially, we have the party primaries creating what I call an eye of the needle, you know, the proverbial tiny eye of the needle through which no problem-solving politician can pass. So there are tons of reasons why our issues are hard to solve. But in some ways, we don't even need to think about those until we realize that the rational incentive to want to get reelected is really the most powerful incentive driving behavior. And if we make it more likely to get reelected, if there is gridlock, if you don't solve something and you just hang on to your ideology and sort of go down fighting on both sides, well, then that's what behavior we're going to get. That's what we see. That's why we have the gridlock. That's why we don't solve anything. And another point, the party primary then is also the reason why both sides like to divide us. They like to make us almost hate each other because it works for them in their reelection strategies. So that's what party primaries do, or that's who participates. But now, you know, we want to, well, actually, and then I guess I did already talk about what they do, which is they affect these results. And what that means is the people in the primaries are the only ones that have power because the elections are decided in the primary. You know, fewer than 20% of elections for the U.S. House are competitive in the general election. So only in the primary is where the decision is made. And if you live in a red district, after the primary is over, you know who's going to win. That's a done deal. So when more people turn up in November, their votes don't matter at all because the decision is basically already made. And it's the same, of course, in a blue district. So regular voters really don't have a chance to impact, which is why when they're legislating, they're not trying to do what regular voters want. They're only trying to do what party primary voters want. And then also, as we've sort of alluded to, what special interests and donors want.
My guest is Catherine M. Gale, founder of the Institute for Political Innovation and co-author of the new book, The Politics Industry: How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Catherine M. Gale, founder of the Institute for Political Innovation, co-author of The Politics Industry, How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. Catherine, it's probably obvious to listeners, but this book deals mostly with the workings of Congress. Why did you choose the legislative branch to explore how well or how poorly the politics industry works for Americans?
Yeah, that's also a good question. So I am a business person, really. I've spent my career mostly in business, some public sector, and I sold my company about 5 years ago to really work on changing the results that Washington, D.C. delivers. The reason we chose Congress is because of something that I've always said in business that actually my co-author originally brought forth, which is strategy is about choosing what not to do. So we can't take on everything. So we have to look for where is the most bang for the buck, essentially. And one of the things we didn't want to do is say, oh, let's work on changing money in politics, because that's going to take a constitutional amendment, which we probably can never get done, or at least not in the current system, but it's such a good idea, we should work on it. We don't want to do that. Or let's work on changing things at the presidential level, but leave Congress untouched, meaning that they still won't deliver any good bills to the president's desk. So we really looked into things that were powerful that would change the results and things that were achievable that we actually have control over. And it turns out that changing the rules of the game for how Congress is elected is both the most powerful thing that we can do to change how they're incented to do their jobs. And it's also reasonably achievable. Now, that doesn't mean easy, but it means reasonably achievable because Article 1 in the Constitution gives all the power to make those rules to the states. None of the actual rules for how we vote are in the Constitution. They've been made up, and therefore we can change them. I would almost use the words whenever we want, but I probably would have to say whenever enough of us want them to be changed, we can change them.
All right, so let's talk about some of these potential solutions. You call for replacing party primaries and plurality voting with something you call final five voting. What is that?
Final five voting is a package of the two most important changes to how we vote. And again, the purpose of making these changes is not necessarily to change who gets elected, but it is 100% to change whatever whoever gets elected does in Washington, D.C. So it's totally nonpartisan. It doesn't favor one party over the other. And in fact, we don't necessarily say that these two parties should go away. We just say they shouldn't be guaranteed to be the only two choices we ever have. If they're not doing a good job, then we should have some other choices. So final five voting changes first the party primary. We've been talking about that. It's totally broken. It means nobody's incented to do what needs doing or they'll lose their jobs. That's a crazy design. We'd never, you know, work in a place where doing our job well meant that we would lose our job.
Right.
Crazy. So let's just get rid of those. And instead, we will have a single primary, not a Democrat primary and a Republican primary. We're going to have one primary. Everybody who's running is on the same ballot. And then the top five finishers advance to the general election. So now we'll have this dynamic competition of five candidates, five sets of ideas. Could be that it's three Republicans and two Democrats, or two Democrats, two Republicans and an independent, et cetera. So even if it's multiple people from the same party, they're going to have different experiences and visions and qualifications, and they will be in that debate holding each other accountable for, you know, what's been done in the past. Now you have those five. Great. The second thing we change after this dynamic, compelling debate is that in the general election, we will now have the opportunity to indicate how we feel about as many of these candidates, you know, that we have an opinion about. Meaning you get to go in and say, this person is my absolute favorite. I really want them to win. They're my number one choice. All the way down to, And this person, this is my fifth choice, my last choice over my dead body. Do I want this candidate to win? And when you rank your choices that way, and you don't have to rank all of them if you don't have an opinion about all of them, you can rank the three you have an opinion about. After that, when the polls close, what we do is we add up all the first place votes. And if we have someone who's got over 50%, well, the election's over and that person wins. But if nobody has support from that true majority over 50% of the district, then we go into a series of instant runoffs. It's just like runoff elections. But instead of having to go back for another election, you cast all your votes at once. So we continue the runoffs. And this is explained in detail in the book, and it's really not complicated, even though at first blush it might seem it. And then we'll always elect the candidate with the broadest appeal to the most number of voters. They will be responsive to all the voters. The general election will be more important than the primary election. Votes will become more important than money. And you won't automatically lose your job if you solve a problem in a bipartisan, sustainable way. Finally, by implementing Final Five, we can have new competition that doesn't become a wasted vote or a spoiler vote. So theoretically, when we do this, we'll start getting better results because the incentives will be different. But now we've added in accountability, because if we don't get better results, then the Republicans and the Democrats are not guaranteed to keep getting elected, because now new candidates from new parties or independents can come in and say, hey, you're not getting the job done, so I want to offer up myself as a choice. And then we, the voters, can choose them. And that's what will make the people in politics pay attention to our real problems and to our lives, and not just the interests of the special interests. Right now, they don't have to pay attention to us. They only have to pay attention to party primary voters and the special interests, where the money comes from and where party primary votes come from. So it's really transformative.
So I think most voters are pretty smart and they really want to make good choices. I'm wondering, though, if this sort of system puts more pressure on individual voters to do a lot of research on what candidates stand for. It's not that people don't want to be informed, but, you know, they've got a lot going on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually another reason why we're starting with Congress. People do tend to pay more attention to those races. But here's the thing. Nobody has to vote for more than one person when you go in. And your vote will be worth exactly what it's always been worth. But it's as if you vote for one person, it's like you're showing up for the election, and then the series of runoffs you decline to participate in. And so it allows an opportunity, but it doesn't disadvantage people who don't want to take that opportunity and want to stick with, you know, sort of the opportunity they've had, which is to indicate their one favorite. But additionally, even if a voter chooses to only quote unquote, say, this is my favorite, and they don't want to rank the rest, they're still way better off, because now their vote in the general election matters. Right now, when they only choose one, they could choose one, they could choose 10, you know, nothing matters right now in the general election in 80% of the districts. So everybody's better off in this system, and the whole system's better off because there's accountability, because new competition can come in.
All right, let's go to the phone. Guy is on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Guy.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, and it sounds like you may have answered my question just a bit, but I'm wondering why America historically has always had this binary party system, when, let's say, other countries in Europe have parties that are more gradient. I'm wondering what the benefit of, and I guess for both people and corporations, and is what you're proposing, would that turn us more toward a more gradient party system? And I'll take my answer off online.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, Guy, that is a great question. So here's the thing. We were really the first modern democracy. And at the time when our founders were figuring out how to get everything set up, they wrote us our, you know, extraordinary constitution, which we can improve over time with amendments. But nonetheless, we've got this great foundation to start with. And then they had to make the day-to-day rules. And the only example they had of how to run an election was the way they ran countryside elections in Britain. And that was whoever has the most votes wins, meaning plurality. So that's what we chose. Political scientists today, I can't speak for every one of them, but in general, they would not recommend that because it has all of those spoiler and wasted votes effects, and it distorts the will of the voter. It distorts it and leads to no competition. So it's a historical relic. That's the primary reason we only have two parties. And then we've sort of doubled down on that by establishing a party primary system, which makes that yet again worse. In other countries, they do a couple of things most often differently than we do. They either have ranked choice voting, which I've just explained, which leads to more different types of candidates and ideas, or they have proportional representation, meaning in a district, they don't just have one winner. They'll have three or four winners, and they'll just divide them according to the proportion of the vote. So even though you may only pick one, if your candidate, you know, your candidate might win, but your neighbor who picks someone else also has their candidate win because you get, four winners out of that district. And in some cases, they use ranked choice voting and proportional representation together. Here's a point, though. Our system remains different than ours. So we have the executive branch and our legislative branch, whereas in many cases, these are parliaments where, you know, the legislators choose, then the chief executive, then they sort of go up and down together. In our case, even if we have more parties, it wouldn't lead to the same kinds of instability that we see when parties get too fractured, because different opinions will not bring down the government. In fact, in our case, with this system, even though we might have different parties, they're all incented to respond to getting things done. So candidly, I would choose this final five system matched with our American Constitution as likely the most optimal way to allow people to have their ideas and their ideologies, we're all for that, but still to get things done instead of just be opposing teams.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you think nonpartisan primaries and these final five general elections would change the climate in Congress at the conclusion of those elections? What would be different when they actually showed up to work on Inauguration Day?
Yeah, a couple things, Chris, because you're right. I appreciate you bringing that up. We care far less about who gets elected, and we care more about what they're thinking and what they're doing when they arrive after Election Day, so what the climate is there. So they're coming in saying, what am I going to need to do to win my next election in the case of 2 years? And they now know that what it's going to take to win the next election is to make over half of the people in their district be happy with the job that they're doing. And they know that if they don't, someone else will come in and have the opportunity to point that out. This person did not get the job done. So now they're not looking. They might still be the same. They might even be the exact same person, and they will have, let's say, the same Republican views or the same Democrat views they had before. But now they can think about having the freedom to drive a solution. Because something very interesting that happens in Washington, D.C. is if you go behind closed doors, actually, even the most ideological elected officials often have the same understanding of the broad outlines of agreement on many of our biggest issues, from immigration to health care to tax policy and entitlements, but they just say, oh yeah, that's basically what we're going to need to do, but I can't vote for that because I won't win my primary. So now, again, back to the climate, they will be coming back to their Congress with looking at the same problems, the same and the same potential solutions, and now they have the freedom to vote yes on those potential solutions and to negotiate on them without automatically knowing they're going to lose their primary. So, and with knowing that they'll have a competitor pointing out they got nothing done if they did. So it's really transformative. And we could talk later if you want about the rules in Congress as well, because those are controlled by the parties and not, they don't work well for solving problems either.
Give me an example of some of those rules. Do you mean which legislation actually gets to a vote, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So, you know, we're fortunate to have a little bit more time today. Right now, I spend most of my time talking about needing to change how we vote to use Final Five voting. But the other thing we're going to want to do as soon as possible after that is we want to change the way they run their business. Think about it for a moment in the context of any organization that, you know, any listener works for. If you were going to solve in your company or your family, shall we say, your biggest problems, I think that there's one thing you probably wouldn't do, which is bring everybody in the company or the family together and say, we need to work on this really hard issue and we have a lot of disagreement, you know, that's challenging. So before we get started, let's count off by twos and then we'll divide ourselves into warring teams who can't stand each other. And then we'll get together and solve it. I mean, no one would do that. It's crazy. And yet we think that's just the way politics is. And there's always going to be some of that. But you can make the rules that sort of accentuate it, make those warring teams the real biggest powerful thing. Or you can make rules that sort of, you know, provide a way to work together nonetheless. And so in Congress, I'll give you an example.
Let me jump in, Catherine, because we need to take a break, and I want you to have time to talk about this. My guest is Catherine M. Gale, founder of the Institute for Political Innovation. Her book is The Politics Industry: How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. Chris Boyd speaking with Catherine M. Gale, former president and CEO of Gale Foods, founder of the Institute for Political Innovation. Her new book is The Politics Industry: How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. You were saying before the break, Catherine, that we can change some of the rules by which Congress gets things done. You don't think it's a great idea to put warring factions together in a room and expect them to solve our most vexing shared problems.
I want to give a quick example of a story, you know, of how this works in practice. So if we can all think back to 2013, we had a huge government shutdown. And the interesting thing about that shutdown that most people don't know about is that it could have been entirely averted, like never happened at all, or ended at any time during those 16 days, if then Speaker John Boehner in the House of Representatives had allowed a vote on a bill that had already been passed by the Senate and that was from the start supported by a majority of the entire House. But because the Speaker has so much power, then John Boehner, now Nancy Pelosi, he at the time didn't allow the vote because he couldn't get a majority of Republicans to be for it. Only some Republicans were for it. And that his ability to not have the vote, like this one person that none of the rest of us elected outside of his district, allowed us, essentially the citizens, to be held hostage in this 16-day shutdown that 90% of us didn't want from the start and that cost our country $24 billion. Now, for those listeners who might think that that shutdown was a good idea, I want to remind all of them that if Republican John Boehner was able to, you know, not hold that vote, then, you know, Democrat Nancy Pelosi doesn't have to hold votes she doesn't want either. And that shutdown ended only when Speaker Boehner broke with his party, broke what's called the Hastert rule, and allowed the vote. And we can't give that kind of political division power to one single head, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, to be able to control what we vote on. And that's one of the reasons why we don't solve problems where a lot of Americans agree, because neither party wants to actually let us vote on those things.
Can you explain the difference, by the way? I just want to go back for a minute to the idea of the final five primary. How is that different from the so-called jungle primaries that are being done, I think, in California and Georgia in order to choose general election candidates?
Right. Well, one of the things is the word jungle primary probably doesn't sound too attractive to people. And that is a word that's been created and popularized by the duopoly, because neither Republicans or Democrats want us to change from the party primaries that we have now. They're both against that change. But it's not really different from those in the sense that now they don't have party primaries. But the huge difference is that in California, for example, they have nonpartisan primaries, but only two people still go to the general election. Whereas what we're proposing is five go to the general election, because really two people is still most likely going to be one Democrat, one Republican. And, you know, it's not enough competition. It's not enough accountability. You'll still sort of have this warring faction. One side is 100% right and the other side is 100% wrong. And so that won't help us the way that having five will.
All right. Let's go back to the phones.
And we shouldn't call it jungle.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go back to the phones and speak with Jim calling from Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks.
Well, first of all, I agree that the system is broken. I agree we need to reform it. I like a lot of the ideas I've heard. Yeah, I like a lot of the ideas I've heard today. I have a question on implementation. Today, the voting mechanism itself, even if it's just two candidates where you have to choose A or B, is confusing to a lot of people, whether it's the machines or the staff not being trained or whatever. And people want to, or people don't vote because of that. They just don't go, or it's too hard. I'm wondering how that's complicated by having a choice of five people that might have to be ranked, and if that actually would disenfranchise a lot of the marginal voters that actually need better representation.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. Again, a really important question, because we don't want these things to be nice in theory and then fall apart when we actually try to, you know, have them in real life. Couple points. First of all, there are lots of countries that use ranked choice voting, you know, where you would be ranking, for example, these five candidates. It actually increases voter participation. Voters are more satisfied with their choices and their expression of those choices. So it has a lot of good effects. And the way that the ballot is designed has been, you know, worked out. So there's generally, and you can see this in the book, you know, a standard way that you design a ballot so that it's not confusing. What you've brought up, Jim, is definitely something that the Democrats and the Republicans, the duopoly, are going to say to tell us why it's bad that we change to this. But there's actually an opportunity in here. First of all, the voting software providers can make their voting software, you know, allow for this ranking. And when we change, if we also need to make other things about our election simpler, you know, states could do that at the same time if they wanted to. So the confusion is kind of it's like a distraction that's going to be brought up by people who don't want us to change because they're going to lose power if we do change. And we just have to pay equal attention to the implementation so it's not sort of intentionally rendered confusing, shall we say.
So the changes you're proposing don't necessarily remove the amount of special interest money swirling around politicians. It simply gives politicians a greater incentive to think about the actual people who show up on election day.
Right. So many people want to reduce the amount of money in politics. And yet the real answer, that's really hard to do because we might need a constitutional amendment to reduce the amount of money. What we want to do is just make sure that money doesn't get what they want to pay for. We want voters to get what they're paying for, meaning voters, we can think of ourselves as sort of paying with votes, and that the special interests are often paying with money. And the challenge in the way our election system works now is that the votes have so little value. It's like, you know, for every dollar, it's really worth only a penny of, you know, per vote. And money, therefore, has so much value. So we don't need to reduce the value of money. We just need to make votes more valuable than money. And then they have to do what the votes want because the money won't come to them, you know, unless they win. So that's the answer.
If elected members of political parties didn't reliably walk in lockstep on just about everything, how do you think the coverage of American politics would have to change in the media?
Yeah, another good point. You know, there's in all of these complex systems, you know, there's always sort of a chicken and the egg. Like, what comes first? Did the media start, you know, creating this war and making it the right versus the left? And did they divide up and have stations that are all considered to be left and these that are considered to be right? Or were the politicians that divided already? Or are the people divided? And in some ways, so I have my opinions about what's happened there. But what's more important than figuring out exactly sort of who started it is figuring out where we have the power to stop it. So if you think about it, if we wanted to say, oh, it would make a big difference if the media didn't pit us against each other. Yeah, that would make a big difference. But you know what? There's no way for us as citizens to decide and force the media to not pit us against each other, right? But we do have a way to force the politicians to be accountable to us, what we want as voters. And we have a way to force the politicians to do things for all of us and to solve problems. And that naturally means that they're not going to be incented. Right now, the reason they divide us is because that's the best way to win. So if we make it that the best way to win is to solve problems and bring us together instead of the best way to win is to solve nothing and make us hate each other, then we'll get solving problems and bringing us more together. Now, look, I get there are complicated problems and we all have different ideas. That's what democracy is. And what we need is a government that can figure out how to solve problems even within disagreement. And candidly, we do that in our lives. We do that in our families. We do that in our businesses. And government absolutely must be expected to do that as well.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, Catherine, what do we do if we want to change these things, but the folks who hold political power right now gained that power by adhering to the traditional way of doing things?
Again, just all the perfect questions, Chris. Okay, here's what's so amazing. Because the Constitution, Article 1, gives the power to make the election rules to the states, each state gets to change these rules individually, and half the states can do it with citizens getting enough signatures to put the issue on the ballot. So let's say in November, if you were in one of those states, then you could go in and vote for your candidates. And then after that, you can vote yes or no on final five voting. And if it gets a majority, then final five voting is now how elections are going to work in that state. And in fact, in three states in November, this is going to be voted on. It's actually final four voting because they're doing top four, but super close. Okay. So, and that's Alaska, Arkansas, and North Dakota, because the citizens said, we want to vote on this. Now in the other states, and I'm pretty sure it's this case in Texas, the legislature has to change the rules and the governor has to sign the bill. But we're only asking them to change the rules in Congress. And as I said earlier, the one thing that everybody agrees on, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, is that Washington, D.C., Congress is broken. People don't agree on whether the president is good or bad. People don't agree on whether the state legislature is doing a good job or not. But virtually everyone agrees that Congress is not. And so asking our state legislatures to solve that problem is actually reasonably doable and very consequential. So we can do that. I actually run a campaign, a legislative campaign for this in Wisconsin, and we're making bipartisan progress. The other thing I want to say to everybody, which is so important, we don't have to change this in all 50 states to start making a difference in the results that we get in DC. If we change these rules in only five states, for example, you would now have 10 senators and let's say maybe 50 to 100, depending on the states, representatives who are there responding to different incentives. So they may still be Republicans and Democrats and have similar ideas, but they now have freedom. They're free. They're out of the thumb of their party leadership. They're responsive to their entire district. And they know they won't lose automatically if they solve a complex problem in a bipartisan way. So if you have 10 in the Senate, then that means that neither party will have a majority on its own, meaning neither party elected under the regular rules will have a majority on its own. And that will change the dynamic immediately. It also gives those people, you know, that know behind closed doors what needs doing, sort of a safety in numbers opportunity to begin to work with them to get things done. So I say to, you know, anybody who's listening in Texas or around the country, to please, you know, look at, well, read our book. We've got fabulous stories. I mean, really stories you won't forget about how screwed it up it is behind the scenes. And then, you know, real good explanations about how we can implement these changes. And then go to my website and basically, you know, connect with us and we can connect you to get this campaign started in your state. I mean, that's what citizens did in Arkansas, Alaska, and North Dakota. And if you're in one of those states, vote yes in November, and also go donate $5 to them and make it happen.
Do you think a system like this could enable the rise of a true third party in American politics, or do we not need that if we get this?
What I would think is that you would absolutely have a third party or a lot of independents come forward at the beginning, and either they will force the existing two to do a better job, and then they'll change how they do business, and they'll pay attention to voters instead of special interests, and they'll solve problems instead of have gridlock, and then they'll sort of keep their role, or they one of them won't, and then this new party will become one of them. I think it's likely we'll have at most three big parties over time, and maybe usually two, but the difference will be is that those two know they only get to be one of the two if they do what we need them to do,
Catherine,
instead of being guaranteed no matter what now.
Catherine M. Gale is founder of the Institute for Political Innovation, former president and CEO of Gale Foods, co-author of the book The Politics Industry, How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. Catherine, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris. I love these questions. Love the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.